this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article, by Emma Patty, is "This CEO's Road to the Aisle Was 60 Years in the Making." Growing up poor in Bermuda, Dr. Cindy Trim Tomlinson always loved the Cinderella story, but it wasn't Prince Charming or the romantic ending that she admired. Instead, it was the character's determination that inspired Cindy the most. No matter what obstacle got in Cinderella's way, she held out for her happily ever after. "We don't weigh in on the cards we are dealt, it's how we play them," Cindy tells OprahMag.com. Even at a young age, Cindy met the world with faith and determination. Cindy's first entrepreneurial venture was a business at 8 years old running errands for neighbors. From there, she put herself through college and went on to claim a seat in the Bermuda Senate by the time she was 30 years old. Alongside her professional success, Cindy also enjoyed a full love life. But in her dating pool, she didn't see the person she wanted to grow old with. "I certainly had my share of dating. I dated a variety of personalities, great men, but most seemed a bit overwhelmed by a woman who knew who she was and did not necessarily need a man to make her feel complete," remembers Cindy. One boyfriend in particular insisted that if they got married, she would need to stay home and give up her career. Cindy knew it wouldn't work and broke up with him. As the years passed, Cindy's friends told her that her ambitions and success might be intimidating to potential romantic partners. But Cindy knew that anyone she was going to marry would need to be confident enough in who he was that he wouldn't be threatened by her accomplishments. "I am a leader, and I knew I didn't have to be dumbed down to be embraced by the man of my dreams," says Cindy. Even though she was sure she would be married by 30, Cindy entered into her 40s not having found a life partner. "I was satisfied when I was single," she explains, adding, "I was not prepared to compromise just to meet this requirement that you grow up, you get educated, you settle down, get married, and have 2.5 children. Instead of worrying about finding the perfect man, Cindy began to set her own expectations of a happy and fulfilling life. A lifelong believer in the power of vision boards and manifesting, Cindy created a vision for the next 20 years and then started crossing things off. She traveled to all 7 continents, became financially independent, studied at Oxford and Harvard, and wrote multiple books about how to find a more meaningful life. But as she breezed happily into her 50s, there was still one part of her vision that remained unfulfilled, a life partner. It was then that Cindy started to consider that she might end up being single for the rest of her life. The thought was haunting," says Cindy. She wondered if she had been too picky in the past. "But even with moments of self-doubt," she says, "I couldn't bring myself to settle just for the sake of settling down." Fast forward to 2016, and Cindy, then age 58, got a call from a former colleague of hers, Russell Tomlinson. "I had a feeling that he was going to ask me on a date, and the answer was absolutely no," says Cindy, who made it a policy to never mix romantic and professional relationships. Despite her best intentions, Cindy found herself having deep and meaningful conversations with Russell. She finally agreed to a date. Then another, and then another. "We spent the first 6 months of dating just talking," Cindy says. "Talking about values, about dreams, about goals, about finances." Not only did Cindy love that they shared so many beliefs and career goals, she also felt right away that she could be completely herself with Russell. For Cindy, who had been a totally independent person, it was an adjustment learning to share her life with someone else. But she says, "He gave me the room to grow in that area. He's both a gentle and a gentleman." One of Cindy's biggest concerns about getting married was that it would interfere with her work goals and busy professional life. "I wanted to marry a person, not a project," Cindy says. So when Russell proposed to Cindy, he chose a moment where she was completely in her element, on stage in front of hundreds of people at a conference in Bermuda. It was an easy yes. "People marry for different reasons," says Cindy, "but I wanted to grow old with this person." Now, Cindy and Russell split their time between Atlanta and Fort Lauderdale, where they each are devoted to their separate careers. Cindy is a thought leader and CEO, and Russell is a preacher and marriage coach. Not only does Cindy love her husband's desire to make the world a better place through his work, but she also enjoys his intellect and sense of humor. "Every night since I got married, I go to bed laughing," says Cindy, who credits their blissful union to the amount of personal work they had each done in their lives before meeting each other. "Like attracts like," she says, adding, "I dated charisma and charm, but married character." Cindy also notes that their vows did not include an obligation to make each other happy. Instead, they see each other as two complete individuals choosing to share their wholeness. As Cindy says, "I bring happiness to the table. I bring wholeness to the table. And that has made a world of a difference for us both." Just like the Cinderella story that she loved as a girl, Cindy sees her story as living proof that you don't have to change who you are to have a fairy tale ending. "I found out that a strong man is never threatened by a strong woman," says Cindy. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is "The Warning Signs of a Dangerous Cult Can Sneak Up on You." And given that no one intentionally sets out to hand their freedom and finances over to a toxic sect, how do you know when you're in one? If the latter question just made you roll your eyes, safe in the knowledge that cults are merely traps for gullible and weak-minded folks, Steve Hassan would urge you to reconsider. The mind control expert is the author of Combating Cult Mind Control, The Guide to Protection, Rescue, and Recovery from Destructive Cults. He's also a former member of the Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church cult. "If you think it could never happen to you, then you're the most vulnerable," Hassan says, "because nobody's impervious." Our collective fascination with cults, and what leads people down the path to zealotry, is reflected in the countless documentaries, TV series, books, and podcasts made about them over the years. Pop culture inspired by Charles Manson and his family is practically a genre unto itself, from Helter Skelter and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood to Emma Klein's fictionalized novel, The Girls. While horror films like Midsommar present a stylized extreme version of what we imagine to be a sect's darkest practices, other real-life groups don't seem sinister at all initially. The Vow, HBO's documentary series about Keith Raniere's Nexum Group, profiles several people who initially thought they were part of a landmark forum-esque personal development organization dedicated to helping people become the best versions of themselves. Years later, they'd realize that Nexum engaged in much more nefarious practices. Here, Hassan explains the warning signs that you or a loved one may belong to a cult, and while we're all more vulnerable than you might think. First, what is a cult exactly? That depends on who you ask, though Merriam-Webster defines a cult as both the great devotion to a person, idea, object, movement, or work, and as a religion regarded as unorthodox or spurious. While the U.S. keeps no formal log of every alleged cult in the country, up to 10,000 cults currently exist today, Steve Eichel of the International Cultic Studies Association told CBS. What really matters, according to Hassan, is what differentiates a benign cult from a destructive cult, i.e., the one you really need to watch out for. There are healthy cults in the sense that you know what you're getting into, he explains, saying this could apply to followers of the Grateful Dead, for example. They don't control who you talk to and what you read. They answer your questions honestly, and you're free to leave if it doesn't work for you. Destructive cults often don't fit the common stereotypes of communes and matching robes. My experience is they live in their houses and apartments going to work. You wouldn't even know they're in a cult unless you start having a conversation with them, he says. A destructive cult is dishonest from the very beginning. Destructive cults always lie to new members about their true intentions, according to Hassan, either through outright untruths or withholding and or distorting vital information so it appears more tantalizing at first. You might think you're getting a free dinner, Hassan says, or, as with Nexium, you're learning a self-help technique. You don't realize that the goal is to get you to sign up for a week course, then it's a 2-week course, a 6-month course, and then they want you to divorce your wife, give over your assets, and work for no money. Know the warning signs of a cult to watch out for. While no two cults are exactly alike, there's significant overlap in the methods they use to burrow into people's lives and become their primary influence. In his BITE model, Hassan divides an extensive list of those common methods into four major categories. Based in research and theory from leading expert psychologists and scholars who've studied brainwashing, BITE stands for Behavior, Information, Thought, and Emotional Control. With mind control cults, there's that hook, Hassan says. You think you're going to improve your life or save children. Who wouldn't want to save the children? And then there's incremental disclosure about what the group is actually about. They only tell you what you think you're ready to swallow, so while you're getting indoctrinated, your critical faculties are getting worn away. That might be through hypnosis, food or sleep deprivation, or forcing them to cut off contact with friends and family. Here's a small sampling of the many practices that are listed under each subcategory. Any group member who encourages or enforces these behaviors should raise major red flags. Behavior control. A group member dictates where, how, and with whom the member lives and associates with or isolates them from others. They regulate your diet through forced fasting. They manipulate a person and deprive them of sleep. They practice financial exploitation, manipulation, or dependence. They impose rigid rules and regulations. Information control. They practice deception by deliberately withholding or distorting information and/or lying. They minimize or discourage access to non-cult sources of information, such as TV, internet, former members, and so on. They make extensive use of cult-generated information and propaganda, such as YouTube, newsletters, movies, and other media. Thought control. They require members to internalize the group's doctrine as truth, black and white, good versus evil thinking. They change a person's name and identity. They use loaded language and cliches which constrict knowledge, stop critical thoughts, and reduce complexities into platitudes and buzzwords. They employ hypnotic techniques to alter mental states, undermine critical thinking, and age regress the member. Emotional control. They manipulate and narrow the range of feelings. Some emotions and/or needs are deemed as evil, wrong, or selfish. They teach emotion-stopping techniques to block feelings of homesickness, anger, and doubt. They make the person feel that problems are always their own fault, never the leader's or the group's fault. They instill fear, such as fear of the outside world, enemies, leaving, or being shunned by the group. Do your research. Be wary of any group that can't give you straight answers to questions, telling you you'll learn more after giving, paying for, or achieving something. Conduct your own research and train yourself on how to spot disinformation online. Hassan points out that any web-savvy organization can game their site, or their multiple sites, so that they flood the top page of your Google search results. For example, the site New Cult Awareness Network sounds like a watchdog group, but is actually owned and operated by the Church of Scientology. Remember that Wikipedia is not a reliable source because interested parties can edit an entry with false information. Ask for the proof. Another common cult tactic, Hassan says, is to deflect skepticism over their beliefs by placing the burden of proof on others to disprove it. For example, an online claim that top-ranking government officials are actually lizard people might send someone who disagrees on an hours-long Googling journey, all to convince the original poster that there's no such thing as lizard people. But the believer is the one who needs to provide proof instead of sending others into reaction mode. If something's legitimate, it'll stand up to scrutiny, Hassan says. The burden of proof is on whomever is claiming an expertise, or a new therapy, or a revelation that's going to save the planet. Again, check the veracity of their sources and remember that a video or photograph can be doctored. Fact check the cult leader. Not every cult has one leader at the top of the pyramid, says Hassan, but you should know the answer to some basic questions about their background. Do they go by their birth name? If not, why'd they change it? Are there any lawsuits? Do they have any criminal records? Have they been involved in previous multi-level marketing schemes? Check every fact listed in their bio to see if they are who they say they are. Hassan recommends that those who suspect their loved one is under the influence of a cult leader hire a private investigator to uncover what internet research might miss. Be aware of your own vulnerability. Hassan calls mind control a bidirectional process between the predator and the person targeted. What plays on one person's fears and vulnerabilities won't work on someone else with a different life experience. But Hassan insists that something will work on everyone if they're not properly educated on what to watch for. How fast does it take someone to get recruited? 10 seconds if the right variables are in place, he says. Or it can take years of erosion. Say you're approached and asked if you want to take a free stress test, Hassan says. You're told you're really smart and you have so many gifts, but there's a few little areas, and if you just fix those, your life will be amazing. You might leave, but you make the mistake of giving them your phone number or email address. They pester you for weeks, months, years. Then maybe you break up with your boyfriend or your friend dies. 6 months later, you get the email from them again saying, "I can really help you be more successful." This can finally convince someone to try it when what they should be doing is surrounding themselves with people they trust. Has someone in your life started spouting theories and beliefs that seem not just absurd, but also wildly out of character? Hassan says the stress and uncertainty of our current social, economic, and political situations, stoked by disinformation that's amplified on social media unchecked, has put all of our defenses down. Between the pandemic and the economic pressures, everyone's super vulnerable, he says. The only way to protect people is by educating them. I've long been guilty of thinking I'm too smart to get sucked into a cult myself, but after almost an hour of speaking with Hassan, I realized something. If someone promised to protect my family and I from the virus, violence, and all of modern society's looming threats, and all I had to do was follow their directions, would I maybe, possibly consider attending an affordable information session? I'm not sure, but I am wearing this tinfoil hat, just in case. Our next article by Michelle Hart is titled, Donnie Walton Shares the Influences Behind Her Debut Novel, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev. Donnie Walton's debut novel, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev, by 37 Inc. and Simon & Schuster, is a howl of a book. The rollicking oral history of a fictional music duo from the 1970s is a revolutionary and resonant anthem that delights in trying to dismantle the myriad forces hampering freedom of expression. Opal, the heart of it all, is an ebony-skinned provocateur, the fashion rebel, the singer, screecher, Afro-punk ancestor, the unapologetically black feminist resurrected via GIFs and Instagram quotes for these intense political times. At the tail end of the 1960s, she meets Nev, a white British folkie with a carrot top and a penchant for Dylan-like lyricism. Together, the unlikely pair ascend to rock legend status. Their ride, however, is anything but smooth, but that's half the fun. Along the road to stardom, we encounter a panoply of quirky characters, flamboyant hairstylists, bumbling record label executives, Skinner-esque southern rockers, and others swept up in Opal and Nev's thrall, all of whom Walton imbues with their own unique voices. I caught up with Walton to talk about the sounds that pulse through the book, how she kept all the many voices both distinct and harmonious, and how her relationship to music has changed since writing the book and during quarantine. Let's start at the beginning. Where did the idea for the book come from? It came from a very personal place. I grew up in northern Florida, which is really southern Georgia. I was really into rock music, especially alternative and indie rock. It was weird for me being a young black woman and being into that kind of music because I hardly ever saw myself reflected. What were some of your favorite bands? I loved this shoegazy band called Ride. I went through an REM phase. I loved The Cure. There was this all-ages club in my town called Einstein A-Go-Go, where I would dance to all this music and hang out with the cool kids. But I was one of the only black kids. That was really difficult for me. Later, I went to an historically black college, where I was able to reconcile the different pieces of my identity, but I was still very interested in that time of fandom in my life. The book was also influenced by this documentary I saw called 20 Feet from Stardom, about background singers who never really got their due. There was footage in there from the Talking Heads concert film Stop Making Sense, and I just had this moment watching David Byrne at center stage dancing in his rectangular gray suit. The camera pans over and we see two black women singing in the background, and I was so fascinated by them. They were so amazing and energetic, and I felt this really strong urge to put my hand literally into the screen and pull one of them to the center of the stage with David. That was the spark, and after that, I couldn't let go. Did you emerge from the documentary with a clear sense of Opal? I started with an image of who I thought she was, but then as I wrote into her childhood and the history of what was going on when she was young, the character began to change. Did she and Nev evolve together in your head? For sure. Really, early on, before I knew who these characters really were, the short pitch I was giving to friends was to imagine if David Bowie and Grace Jones made music together in the 70s. They were almost archetypal figures in terms of being two very strange and different-looking people coming together in this way. But I think I had a handle on Opal a lot earlier in the process than Nev, who began to surprise me. In what ways? Well, I thought of him as someone who would be chameleon-like. I had written about half of the book by the fall of 2016 when the election happened, and I just began to think about what it would mean, not just in terms of style or music, but in terms of personhood, for someone to be changeable. Did you always know you wanted to tell the story as an oral history? Was it ever a more straightforward novel? It was always an oral history. It's basically a result of working for many years at Entertainment Weekly, where the oral history was a form we used often to write about big and beloved movies or albums. And I love the way the voices interplayed, how memories could contradict one another. It's a really fun style. When I started writing, I was doing it for myself during downtime on my day job. It was fun to channel the voices in a way that felt raw and free. The first pages I wrote were of Opal and Pearl, Opal's sister, talking about their childhoods. It wasn't until later that the Sunny character became a part of it. The book is being curated in present day by Sunny, the first black editor of a major music magazine, whose father was Opal and Nev's drummer. Was there an aha moment when you realized that the narrative had to be filtered somewhat through Sunny's point of view? Some of my classmates at Iowa, where I was workshopping the book, were curious about the person all these people were talking to. Who was this person curating and selecting the stories? So I wanted to have a character with a very deep interest in this duo who could be representative of sorts for the current timeline, in order to see how the present and the 1970s are in conversation. In an early draft, Sunny was part of the oral history, a character who was interviewed about Opal having paid her way through college and her not knowing this. That was an interesting little nugget, and I pulled it to the foreground. There's such a wide variety of characters in the book. What was the process of getting into those characters' heads and preserving their unique voices? I was thinking a lot about rhythm and syntax, how people put sentences together, and about the kind of curse words characters would and would not say and why. That was very helpful to get into the characters. I lived in a lot of different places. I'm Southern born, but have been living in New York for 20 years. I lived in Portland, Oregon for a couple years. I was in Iowa in the Midwest, and I just have always been very attuned to voices and the way that people speak. Was there one character who proved particularly easy to tap into? Opal's voice was the first one that came very clearly to me. The thing that I always have to keep in mind is that she's from Detroit, but we, all us black folks, have Southern roots. So the things we say or the way we construct a sentence or use slang, it feels at times kind of universal. She sounds Southern in a way that I recognize from my family. So yeah, her voice came through very clearly for me. Pearl too, but in a different way. I was thinking about some of the older church ladies I've known in my life and my family. You mentioned talk shows and Grace Jones, and in the book you reference Mary Clayton's work with the Rolling Stones on Gimme Shelter. Were there any more literary influences that helped you while you were writing? I read a lot of nonfiction, mostly. The Saturday Night Live oral history is one of my absolute favorites, called Live from New York by Tom Shales. That was fantastic. In terms of fiction, I've always loved books that play with form and do interesting things. If I think about the brief, wondrous life of Oscar Wilde and the usage of footnotes in there to bring in history that made me be like, okay, that's been done before, so maybe it's not so crazy for me to do it. Halfway through the book, there's a discussion about a photo in which Opal is ripping up the Confederate flag. In some ways, the book hinges on this image. Where did that come from? You know, I'm from Jacksonville. That's where Lynyrd Skynyrd are from. The Confederate flag has been an image that's been in my face my whole life. You see it in gas stations there. If you go to the beach, you see it on bikinis. Growing up, we had toy cars like the one from Dukes of Hazzard. It's terrifying. Are there any photographs that struck you as influential that you thought of when you were writing that discussion into the book? I'm so glad you asked that question. I used to work for Life.com, which was the rebirth of the photography magazine. I was basically deep into the archives all the time. It was my job to put together these photo essays in which we would think about the context of an image, going through the photographer's notes, sometimes interviewing the people who took the pictures, and sometimes just dreaming into the image in different ways. In terms of images that were influential, I did think about the Kent State photo in terms of how it was representative of a tumultuous moment in time, and also everyone was very curious about the young woman in that photo. I was also thinking about what makes something feel iconic, like Steve McQueen in the California desert with a cigarette dangling from his mouth. Has your relationship to music changed since you started writing the book? I am a person who is very much stuck in the past, and I think it's because I am very nostalgic for a time when there were physical products, like actual albums with liner notes and cover art. It was an experience to put on an album and read the words alongside it. Those are memories I tie to older music. And I would say where my listening stops is probably the early aughts, my early years in New York City. I feel on one hand very embarrassed about that, but on the other hand, I'm still learning about black artists and rock that I had never heard of before. There's still so much to discover. Do you have an example? There was a very early grunge band called Bam Bam out of Seattle. They were led by a black woman named Tina Bell. I think they were sort of big on a local scale, but never really able to break out. She actually passed away in 2012. I'm just looking at these pictures and watching old grainy videos of concert performances near tears because they're so good and I had no idea who she was. There have been many artists like that. There's a book published just last fall called Black Diamond Queens by Maureen Mahone about African American women's contribution to rock and roll. It goes all the way from Big Mama Thornton, who was the first person to record Hound Dog, later covered by Elvis, all the way through the success of Tina Turner. But there are so many different women in between that it sent me to Spotify, and I was going down rabbit holes. I've been digging deeper into what I don't know of the past. Has your relationship to music changed since COVID and lockdown? I definitely don't listen to music the way that I used to. If it's on, I'm all in it, and so I can't have it on when I'm working, and I'm working all the time on different things. And sadly, live music is just a no-go right now. What was the last concert you saw? Oh my gosh, for my husband's birthday, I took him to see Gladys Knight, and we were the youngest people there. It was hilarious, but she was so, so great. That's a good last concert. I mean, not that it's the last one. Right, we're not going to put that energy out there. Our next article by Kieran Johnson is titled Jane Elliott, creator of the Blue Brown Eyes Experiment, says racism is easy to fix. The lives and legacies of Dr. Jane Elliott and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. are inextricably linked. On April 4, 1968, King was killed by the single bullet of a lone assassin as he stood outside room 306 on the second floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. The reverberations of that fateful day would be felt the world over, but it was the following day that would change Elliot's life forever. Paying homage to King, it was then that the white school teacher in the all-white town of Riceville, Iowa, devised an exercise to enable her third-grade students to experience firsthand what prejudice, discrimination, and racism felt like. In what is now famously known as the Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes exercise, Elliot divided her class into two groups based on a characteristic over which they had no control: eye color. Blue-eyed students were placed in one group and brown-eyed students in the other. Members of both groups were treated according to the color of their eyes. On the first day, Elliot convinced the brown-eyed students that they were better, smarter, and superior to their blue-eyed counterparts, and as such, they were entitled to privileges such as more recess time and access to a water fountain. The next day, she reversed the roles. Elliot was astounded by the results. In a PBS documentary about her work, entitled A Class Divided, she said, "I watched wonderful, thoughtful children turn into nasty, vicious, discriminating little third graders." For decades, Elliot repeated the exercise with elementary school students, college students, and professionals around the world, consistently finding that participants would turn against each other for no other reason than the color of their eyes. Today, Elliot still believes, as she did back in 1968, that white people keep feeling, thinking, and talking this racist way until they've experienced some of the same treatment that people of color live with every day. At the time, the exercise was considered controversial, in part because for just a few short hours, it forced white people to experience a semblance of the pain black people do. For instance, it wasn't uncommon for white participants, who likely hadn't experienced overt discrimination based on their skin color, to abandon the exercise in fits of rage, and sometimes even in floods of tears. Such was the perceived level of humiliation and powerlessness they experienced. Overall, however, the exercise demonstrated that, if prejudicial, while discriminatory and racist behaviors can be learned, they can also be unlearned. In the wake of the police killing of George Floyd on Memorial Day, archival clips of Elliot's exercise began making the rounds on social media, thrusting her anti-racism work back into the spotlight it had occupied 52 years prior. Particularly relevant in this racially charged climate, Elliot's experiential exercise is a palpable representation of discrimination in action. And more than five decades later, Elliot is still a force to be reckoned with. At 86 years old, the pioneer of the anti-racism exercise is still in demand, and she's as straight-talking, incisive, and quick-witted as ever. Speaking from her home in the rolling plains and cornfields of Iowa, the former schoolteacher turned anti-racism educator hasn't lost a step since she first hit TV screens in 1992 on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Despite being universally recognized as the creator of the famed exercise, Elliot is quick to refute this. Instead, she only lays claim to having adapted it. "I didn't create the exercise. I learned it from Adolf Hitler," she tells OprahMag.com matter-of-factly. "One way he decided who went into the gas chamber was by eye color. If you had a good German name, but you had brown eyes, they made sure you went to the gas chamber because they thought you might be a Jewish person who was trying to pass. They killed hundreds of thousands of people on the basis of eye color alone." Raised on a farm in northeast Iowa, Elliot was born in 1933, the same year Hitler came to power, and she often likens the current state of race relations in the U.S. to Hitler's exploits in Europe from 1933 to 1945. In adapting the exercise, Elliot says her intention was that anybody going through it would relate to what Jews went through then and what blacks are going through now. "I wanted people to experience that and gain empathy. Not education, but empathy." But the uphill battle to defeat racism isn't just about lack of empathy. It's about economics. Prince Harry was recently quoted as saying, "When it comes to institutional and systematic racism, it's there and it stays there because someone somewhere is benefiting from it." Elliot agrees. "Racism is profit-making behavior," she says. She adds, "Read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness." Thanks to people like Bill Clinton, who started the three strikes and you're out nonsense, we put mostly young black males in prison. They're forced to work 8 hours a day, and in many cases, they're paid 20 cents an hour. It's a new form of slavery. Make no mistake about this, it's a way to make a lot of money. Whatever the reason for the perpetuation of racism, its harmful effects have long been well documented. In 1969, the Joint Commission on Mental Health of Children acknowledged that racism was America's number one public health problem among children. Tellingly, Elliot points out, they didn't say black children, they said all children. She continues, thinking your skin makes you superior is absolutely ridiculous. To think somebody else's skin color makes that person inferior is equally ridiculous, but much more harmful. Because if you think you're right and everybody else is wrong, and you can get enough people to agree with you, you can destroy people of color on a daily basis. We do that all day in this country. Fast forward 51 years from the Joint Commission's report to 2020. Last July, CNN shared findings from a study that revealed that racial discrimination may increase stress, lead to health problems, and hamper the cognitive function of black women. Why black women in particular? Elliot believes it's because their sons and husbands are in constant danger. As has been amply demonstrated over the past few months, during wartime, we send black men to fight in our wars and die. In peacetime, we make war on them in this country. Black women know that. Despite her scathing assessment of the state of U.S. race relations, Elliot fervently believes that racism is easy to fix. She offers a two-part solution to the problem. The first is philosophical, and the second is practical. Step one, stop believing there's more than one race. Realize that we're all members of the same race, the human race. She adds that from the age of 5 to 18, people aren't educated, but rather indoctrinated, to believe in the myth of white superiority. But any myth can be debunked, and Elliot outlines the roadmap to destroy the myth of race using the same tool that was used to construct it, literature. I'd start by insisting that every child reads the book The Color of Man by Robert Cohen, she said. I'd also insist that every educator reads all the books listed in the bibliography on my website. Step 2, change housing segregation practices. In an interview with Slate magazine, Richard Rothstein talks about his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. He rejects the idea that America's metropolitan areas are de facto segregated, that is, the product of private individuals' choices about where to live. According to Rothstein, most residential segregation can't be attributed to the private choices of homebuyers or even prejudices held by realtors and lenders. And the separation of many U.S. neighborhoods has been at the core of federal housing policies for decades. Elliot, too, believes that racially segregated neighborhoods in the U.S. are the product of de jure segregation, residential segregation that is mainly a consequence decided by law rather than a matter of personal choice among residents. Anybody who thinks all the residential segregation we have is de facto segregation is wrong. Believe me, this can be taken care of. We simply have to change these housing segregation practices. While Elliot shows no signs of calling time on her anti-racism activism, she does have her eyes firmly fixed on the future of the exercise that made her famous. She's even contemplating passing the torch to some of her family members so they can follow in her footsteps. Whether they choose to lead the exercise with third-grade students, college students, professionals, or all of the above, as Elliot did. I have a daughter who would be good at leading the exercise, so she's studying to do it. I also have three granddaughters who could lead it very well. Because they've listened to me a lot, they've learned some things that convince them that a lot of what they learned is nonsense, she said. An essential part of the exercise, which Elliot says she hates, involves being unrelenting in her ridicule and humiliation of the inferior group, subjecting them to discriminatory statements like, brown-eyed people are better than blue-eyed people. This is a fact. According to Elliot, white women have to lead the exercise because people won't listen to black women. Coming from a man, no one is going to put up with the kind of things I say during the exercise. They'll take it from a woman. They'll take it from a white woman. Ultimately, Elliot is shocked and saddened that the need for her anti-racism exercise is as pressing in 2020 as it was in 1968. For her, she says it's a bit like watching the movie Groundhog Day. where the main character wakes up in the morning only to realize that he's reliving the same day over and over again. So what motivates Elliot to continue her anti-racism endeavors? What motivates the racist to carry on? She asked in response. The racists carry on, so I carry on. When they stop, I will. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is The True Story That Inspired Dirty John Is Even Scarier Than the Show. When 59-year-old Deborah Newell first met John Meehan in October 2014, she thought she found the one. Or, if not the one, then at least a nice guy to make up for the string of online dates and four failed marriages that came before him. The owner of a successful interior design business and the mother of four children, Deborah had everything, except romantic love. So maybe that's why Deborah overlooked Meehan's slightly strange behavior, like showing up for their formal date inexplicably wearing hospital scrubs or saying all his clothes had been stolen. Or maybe she overlooked Meehan's strangeness because after years of conning, Meehan was an expert at making people do precisely that. Meehan had a history of manipulating and abusing women with a criminal track record to show for it. Unwittingly, Deborah Newell and her family were Meehan's latest target. Dirty John, which originally aired on Bravo in November 2018, tells the story of how the Newells became Meehan's last target, too. The 8-episode show is adapted from Christopher Gofford's excellent reporting on Meehan's life and mysterious death in Newport Beach, California, for the LA Times in 2017, unfurled in a series of 6 articles and an accompanying popular podcast called Dirty John. As of November 25th, 2019, this harrowing true story, wrapped up in the good looks and good lighting of primetime TV, is available to stream on Netflix. Eric Bana plays the ultimate swindler, John Meehan. Connie Britton is Deborah, trusting and vulnerable. Deborah's daughters, Juno Temple and Julia Garner, play 2 young women who try to save their mother from her own decisions. Ultimately, Dirty John is a character study in evil. Evil is a big word, but when people who knew him speak about Meehan, that's the word they reach for. When Meehan first walked into lawyer John Gisalo's Santa Ana office, Gisalo was struck by a thought. I am sitting here in the presence of evil incarnate, Gisalo recalled, thinking in the Dirty John podcast. You know that people like him really do exist, and one has just come into your orbit. Scariest man I've met in my 70 years. Before watching Dirty John, here's a basic rundown of what you need to know. In October 2014, Deborah Newell and John Meehan met through a dating app. It's possible to read Dirty John as a horror story about online dating. Newell first met Meehan through a dating app for older singles. She was instantly charmed by the man sitting across from her at dinner. Newell was impressed by his career as an anesthesiologist and his time serving in Doctors Without Borders in Iraq. He was the total package, a doctor, very intelligent, a family man, Newell recalled on Megyn Kelly Today. She elaborated on Fox 5. He tended to have everything on my checklist that I was looking for. Newell fell in love, and she and Meehan went full steam ahead on their new relationship. 5 weeks in, they moved into a beautiful $6,500 a month house on Balboa Island. 2 months in, they eloped in Las Vegas. No guests attended the wedding, and no prenuptial was signed to protect Newell's sizable assets. He kept saying, I can't wait to be married to you, and just, I'm so in love with you, and so on. I felt that this was an opportunity to love again, Newell said on the Dirty John podcast. Over the course of their courtship, Newell isolated herself from her daughters. They saw something in Meehan that Newell didn't. Menace. Newell's daughters were less charmed by Meehan. Jacqueline, called Veronica and played by Juno Temple in Dirty John, and Tara Newell, played by Julia Garner, 2 of Newell's 3 daughters, were distracted by questions about their mother's new love interest. If John was a doctor, why were his fingernails so dirty? Why did he look so disheveled? Why was money disappearing from Deborah's wallet? Why couldn't John ever give a straight answer to questions about his life? He was just very standoffish. We would ask him questions and he would want to give us a one-worded answer, Tara said during an appearance on Megyn Kelly Today. He didn't want to look us in the eyes and his social skills were just kind of off with me and my sister. At the time, 23-year-old Tara was living outside Las Vegas with her then boyfriend, and 24-year-old Jacqueline was living with her mother in California. I told my mom she'd better get this creep out of the house, or I don't plan on living with her, Jacqueline said on the Dirty John podcast. Instead, Newell and Meehan only became closer. Then they moved in together. Tara and Jacqueline later looked into Meehan by hiring a private investigator. They also involved their cousin Shad, called Toby and played by Kevin Zegers in the show. By March 2015, 4 months after their wedding, Deborah would come to learn what her daughters already knew. Meehan was dangerous. By then, though, the chain of events depicted in Dirty John had already gotten started. Deborah was already isolated from her family and locked in a dangerous on-again, off-again relationship with Meehan that would culminate in emotional manipulation, a destroyed car, and an attempt on a family member's life, among many other grievous twists. Meehan had a long history of deceitful behavior. According to Meehan's sisters, who spoke to Gofford, Meehan was taught the art of the grift by his father, William. At a young age, Meehan acquired his father's skills, like pulling off insurance scams and filing bogus lawsuits. John was a hustler, Meehan's sister, Karen Duvalier, told the LA Times. Whatever he had to do to get money, he would do. Eventually, Meehan was busted for selling cocaine and forced to leave California as part of a plea deal. That's how he ended up at the University of Arizona and then the University of Dayton Law School, where his classmates christened him with the nickname Dirty John. It stuck. In fact, according to video footage Gofford found, the nickname was even mentioned during a toast at his wedding, his first wedding. Meehan served time in prison. The story begins when Meehan met his first wife, Tanya Sells, played by Sprague Graydon, a practicing nurse anesthetist in 2000. She helped him become a nurse anesthetist too. After 12 years as a couple and two children together, Meehan abruptly filed for divorce. Sells was spurred to search for evidence of why he would leave so abruptly. I didn't start investigating his past until the end, until he asked me for a divorce, and I was like, something's not right here, Sells said in an interview with Extra. Sells contacted his family and rooted through their Ohio home. To her shock, she found boxes of the surgical anesthetics Versed and fentanyl, which she believed Meehan was stealing and using. She contacted the police with her findings. Though Meehan lost his job, he was still allowed to work at other hospitals, where he caused further trouble. Meehan reportedly brought a gun into an operating room. He also frequently harassed and threatened his ex-wife until she took him to court, where he was convicted of menacing behavior and received a suspended sentence. Meanwhile, Sells' police report began an 18-month investigation that will culminate in his conviction. In 2002, Meehan pled guilty to drug theft charges. He served 17 months in a Michigan prison. After being released from prison in 2004, Meehan moved in with his sister Donna in California. Deborah Newell was not Meehan's first victim from a dating site. According to Donna, Meehan spent his first night out of prison on Match.com. She knew what it meant. He was looking for victims, Gofford wrote in the LA Times. Which brings us to Deborah, 9 years later, poking around the internet for information about her new husband. What she found shocked her. Meehan's name was listed on datingpsychos.com, a site where women share information on potentially dangerous men, along with chilling comments like, "Do not let this man into your life," and "Don't be fooled by his charming personality." Gofford gives the full details in his 2018 book, Dirty John and Other True Stories of Outlaws and Outsiders. From 2005 to 2014, from about the time he got out of prison in Michigan for drug theft to the time he met Deborah Newell in California, he had seduced, swindled, and terrorized multiple women, many of whom he had met on dating sites while posing as a doctor, court records showed. By the time they married in December 2014, three separate women around Southern California had standing restraining orders against him. In recent years, at least three others had requested them, Gofford wrote. How did John Meehan die? Dennis Lucan, an investigator for the Warren County Sheriff's Office in Ohio, who began looking into Meehan in 2002, correctly predicted how the story would end. I knew this case was going to go on until either somebody killed him or he killed somebody, Lucan told the LA Times. As Lucan suspected, Gofford's podcast begins with the reading of an autopsy report. How did Meehan end up dead of 13 stab wounds in 2016? As Dirty John shows in its graphic finale, Tara Newell, then 25, killed Meehan after he deliberately attacked her in a parking lot with a knife. At the time, Meehan was estranged from Newell and living in Nevada. He drove to California with the intent to attack Newell's youngest daughter. The man grabbed me from my waist and said, "Do you remember me?" I did and knew he was there to kill me, Tara wrote in a first-person essay for People.com. Tara credits her years spent binge-watching The Walking Dead with her life. Once she got a hold of Meehan's knife, Tara went after him like the characters in The Walking Dead go after zombies. "A stab to the head or a shot to the head, and then you kill a zombie," she said in the podcast. "You need to kill their brain." She began to stab him repeatedly. The last one was in the eye. "So I guess that was my zombie kill," she added. The creators of Dirty John took pains to recreate the violent scene. "The real Tara spoke to the stunt coordinator and gave really good detail," Eric Bana explained to Refinery29. "She was able to provide some really specific marks of what happened." You can watch all 8 episodes of Dirty John on Netflix for all the other wild twists that you just couldn't predict. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is Books to Give the World's Best Dad on Father's Day. Miracle at St. Andrews, a novel by James Patterson and Peter DeJong. This novel is an obvious pick for dads who are happiest out on the green. Miracle at St. Andrews follows one man's journey back to the birthplace of golf with the intention of finding the secret to the game. Unlike James Patterson's thriller fare, Miracle at St. Andrews is more inspiring than it is nail-biting. Every Tool's a Hammer by Adam Savage. The handyman dad will love this book. Star of the Discovery Channel's Mythbusters, Adam Savage challenges readers to take a deeper look at what inspires them when it comes to making and molding, building and breaking, offering his own tips and tricks along the way about his favorite techniques and tools. Born a Crime by Trevor Noah. The comedian and Daily Show host gets candid about his childhood struggles as he grew up in apartheid South Africa to a white father and black mother. His existence was a crime, but somehow, with the help of his mom, he became a man that brings joy to so many. Less by Andrew Sean Greer. In this Pulitzer Prize-winning humorous nonfiction book, a troubled, nearly 50-year-old novelist sets out on a trip around the world after receiving a wedding invitation from his ex of 9 years. Black Leopard, Red Wolf by Marlon James. If your father loves fantasy, this book is for him. One of the most celebrated novels of 2019, and likened to the African Game of Thrones, James combines mythology and history through a story of a skilled mercenary who's sent to track down a missing child. Dad Jokes. Does your dad frequently crack himself up? Keep his dad joke jar full with this book, which is teeming with them. You may groan at the jokes, but he'll be thrilled. Hair Love by Matthew Cherry. Hair Love is a lovely choice for dads looking to read to their daughters. Inspired by an Academy Award-winning short film, Hair Love follows a father learning to do his daughter's hair for the first time. Heartwarming and critically acclaimed, Hair Love is on its way to becoming an HBO Max TV show centered on the book's young family. Super Dad Personalized Book. This custom book turns dad into the superhero. Simply send the Etsy vendor a pic of him and tell him the book is from the kids. The Mamba Mentality, How I Play by Kobe Bryant. In the wake of his 2016 retirement, the late LA Lakers NBA star, who had four daughters of his own, shared the secret to his famed Mamba mentality and how he excelled at the game of basketball. Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches by John Hodgman. Get Vacation Land for the dad that loves to laugh, because he'll be doing a lot of that while reading this unusual memoir. John Hodgman is known for his appearances on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, his podcast, and humorous other books. Ostensibly about his family's move from Massachusetts to Maine, whose state slogan is Vacation Land, Hodgman also offers insights on middle age, mustaches, fatherhood, weird dad hobbies, Stephen King, rock and roll, and more. Be Prepared by Gary Greenberg and Jeannie Hayden. If the guy in your life has a baby on the way and is a soon-to-be first-time dad, Be Prepared serves as a helpful handbook and survival manual for those early days of fatherhood. My Dad Loves Me by Mariana Richmond. This heartwarming picture book is the perfect pick for dad to read to his young kids, as it illustrates all the ways a father can show love. Your Baby's First Word Will Be Dada by Jimmy Fallon. Father of two and The Tonight Show host, Jimmy Fallon, wrote this hilarious picture book about all dads' efforts to make sure their kid's first word is dada. The Adventures of Barry and Joe by Adam Reed. This is for the dad who just happens to love comic books, politics, and the endearing friendship between former President Barack Obama and current President Joe Biden. Described as both graphic and novel, it follows the fictional adventures of the former POTUS and current POTUS as time-traveling superheroes who fight to save America's future. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.